Chris and Xiaogang for the invitation. It's my great pleasure to visit again, probably my third time here. Today I will talk about some approach to holography, to this our ADS-CFT duality that I'm trying to proposing. And it's in particular a pleasure to talk about it here because one of the direct motivation of this work was the entanglement workshop last I think it was April or something like that, when I visited here and I finally understood Giffrey's idea about multi-scale entanglement renormalization, and this is you will see is directly related to this to MIRA approach. So okay, so I will start from so before introducing the details of this work, I will start from a motivation. So which I would like to call a permanent understanding to holography. So it means someone who don't understand string theory. How do I understand holography, and why is that interesting for the general systems? And then I will discuss in detail like what do I mean by this exact holographic mapping, which is a mapping in Hilbert space. And I will study that for this very simple free fermion model and show that it gives you some interesting information about the space-time geometry. And I will discuss some more general systems in the end. So I will just very briefly review this holographic duality. So it was a obtained in a string theory context that was proposed by these works of Malasina and et al. This was discovered at the beginning. It was like a specific theory, like SU and Yang-Mir's, some supersymmetric Yang-Mir's theory, and in the larger limit. And then you know both sides very well, and then this is due to a gravity theory. But the reason why it attracts more, I mean, one of the reasons why it attracts more and more interest also from condensed matter is that it's believed to be much more general than in this particular theory. And there is an intuitive way to understand why, in general, we expect something like this duality to happen. And intuitively, as pointed out in these works, there is a relation of this duality to renormalization group. It's like this additional dimension you introduce is like a renormalization group. So your physical system, what you call the boundary system, is something living on this slice, which may be a d-dimensional space. And then the dual system lives on d plus one dimensional space. And this actual dimension is like an RG, where the renormalization group flow equation is generalized to equation of motion or action of the bulk. So when the bulk is classical, then you really reduce to some kind of classical equation like the renormalization group equation. So the people in condensed matter are interested in this approach as a way to describe strongly correlated systems when the dual system is easier to describe. I'm interested in how to understand this in a sort of constructive way, or you can say top-down approach, which means you start from a macroscopic theory, and then how do you build the bulk in a constructive way, rather than starting from some gravity theory and then use it as an effective theory to describe the system. So for example, Songsik has a lot of works along this direction, and that's also part of the motivation of my work, that I'm trying to do such a constructive approach. And this one is more based on quantum state rather than the action. So we believe it's maybe really equivalent. So now let's start from some very general discussion. I want to ask, okay, why is this this holography and the gravity naturally comes in when you talk about, when you try to understand the description of a many body system? So I would like to start from this very general question, like how do I know the geometry of the space-time for a quantum state? Like, I mean, this sounds like very philosophical, but But basically what I mean is I give you a quantum state, which means I give you a quantum system, which means I give you a Hilbert space and Hamiltonian, but I didn't specify like which basis is real space basis. Then what do? You check different bases, and then you say some of them looks like real space basis, some of them doesn't, right? You may have momentum basis which doesn't look like real space. So what do I exactly mean when I say that? So if I don't give you this real, what do I mean by real space a priori, then there are two questions you have to answer in order to understand what geometry is your system living on. Like some Hamiltonians, it's just a matrix, but some Hamiltonian looks like a particle hopping on a torus. Something may look like a particle on a sphere. What determines that? So you need to answer these two questions. One is what do you mean by a point? And that's basically a choice of basis. It means that I pick a set of basis which are local in real space. So you have, so if you think about spin systems, then you pick a basis that are direct product of spins on each side. And that's what you define to be point. And if you define a different basis in the Hilbert space, which is direct product of some spins, say in momentum basis or some other basis, then that means you pick a different set of points. And there are, of course, some choices which are more reasonable. And I think the way to distinguish the different choices is that it only makes sense if you have a choice where the physics is local. So that's related to the second question. Like, if I pick a choice of this basis, which defines what do I mean by points in the space, say points means delta function in this space, then what do I mean by distance between points? So if I don't know anything, I just give you this Hamiltonian, and I don't have a ruler which comes from outside, which gives you some geometry adding by hand. Then we don't know in general how to define the distance, but it must be something determined by the physical correlation functions in the system. Right? It's just relativity principle. It means that the geometry should be something measurable, right? Something you can measure if you live in that system. Okay, so these are the two principles I'd like to take. So let's take a simple example to try to translate this into more accurate formulas. So take this simple example of, some spin system which is in a short-range correlated state. So every set is a spin 1/2, and then this link means they form a singlet. So if I think about superpositions of different configurations, different ways to pair these spins, but each configuration has very short singlet, then this is like a short-range correlated state. So if you calculate spin-spin correlation, you get some exponential decay the correlation function, right? So this choice of basis, which is a real space spin, determines a set of points, and then with this given set of points, now if I want to measure distance between two points, what can I do? I will measure the correlation function between the spins, because the system has only the spin on each side, there's nothing else. So I measure the correlation function between spins, and then in this gapped state, I will get an exponential decay. There may be some power law factor, but it's dominated by this exponential in long distance. So what I want to say is that, okay, so now if you live in this system, then you measure the correlation function, and then you can try to back out the distance from this correlation function behavior. So for this particular example where the state is short-range correlated, and that usually means the Hamiltonian is gapped, you are in the ground state of a massive state, then the way you back out distance from correlation function is you take a log of the correlation function, because the correlation function decays exponentially. And physically, what you are doing is this exponential decay comes from the fact that that the correlations are propagated locally. Like these two sides are correlated because this one is correlated with its neighbor and so on. So like if you do some kind of expansion, you can see that like you get contribution from different paths, and then in the long distance it's dominated by the shortest path. Okay, so that means that for this kind of a massive system, I can translate this idea that physical correlation determines geometry into a formula. That means I calculate the correlation function, take a log, then up to an overall constant, I will determine the distance between the two points. And if I do that for that system in the last slide, this distance dxy in the long distance, in the large scale, will just recover the Euclidean geometry we have, right? So if you put that system on a curved manifold, it will recover that Riemann geodesic distance in a curved manifold. So you see, this is a trivial example where I want to define the distance by some physical correlation function. And one more comment is that if I want to do it in a more universal way, because in this system I have spin-spin correlation, but you also have, say, dimer-dimer correlation or something else. So in general, you may not know, let's say you calculate some correlation function which is very short range, but there may be some other thing which are long range correlated. So you don't want to miss that. So there is an unbiased choice, which means you use mutual information. And then when you use mutual information, which is like the entropy of one site plus the entropy of the other site, subtracting the entropy of the two together, that's a characterization of entanglement between these two sites, or correlation between the two sites. So there is this exact formula given by that paper that tells you that the mutual information is the upper bound of all the two-point functions. So that means that if you use mutual information and put that in this formula, then you see mutual information decays exponentially in some way, then that guarantees that there is nothing that's longer range than this. So you can use that as an unbiased definition of your distance, like that. Right. So, okay, so, and then this gives you another nice observation that this distance has there is a nice feature of this distance, which is, so what you put here should be the maximum of the visual information, right? Because when you have less correlation of the two sides, they are farther away. So the shortest distance you can have is when the mutual information is maximal, right? So when the mutual information is maximal, where I node is like the entropy of the two sides together, then you have distance zero. But what does that mean? Well, in which case the mutual information will be maximal? It's just when these two sides form a maximal entangled state, right? That's the most, that's the highest possible mutual information you can have. That means the entropy of the two together is zero and they are entangled with each other. Okay, so this formula tells me that this distance is zero between such two sides. And that's a reasonable statement, because when you have two sides which are maximally entangled, we know any operator acting on this side is equivalent to an operator which is the transpose matrix acting on the other side. So there is no sense of something that's close to this one but far from the other. Because if you access this, it's the same as you access that, right? So it just says that this distance definition makes physical sense. And that's actually a formula that realizes this idea of ER equals to EPR in this paper of Juan Molesina and Lenny Susskind. So here ER means Einstein-Rosen bridge, which means there's a wormhole between them, and EPR means EPR pair between the two. It tells you that that if you have two things that are highly entangled, it's like there's a wormhole between them. Yeah.
So before you were talking about the point is basically the basic state.
Right.
So it's an entire state of the system. Is it?
Well, it's more precisely, yeah, a set of points correspond to a basis in the Hilbert space, but it corresponds to how I decompose this set of bases into direct products. So to be more precise, a point is like a factor space in Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space is a direct product of all these local Hilbert spaces. And then you can decompose it in a different way. Right?
Because you were talking about the distance between points, I saw this distance between two wave functions. But here you are talking about distance between two parts of the same wave function.
Right, the Hilbert space, I mean, the many body wave function lives in this exponentially big Hilbert space. So when I talk about distance between two points, it's correlation between the two points in that wave function. Like for any given wave function, I can calculate a set of correlation functions. We will later talk about even space-time correlations, which will involve not only states but Hamiltonians. But in general, in the single particle, you talk about wave functions here and here. But in many body sense, you just talk about correlation functions in a given many body wave function. Yeah.
If you have an EPR pair between two distant sites, then indeed you could do teleportation to send one state from here to there.
Right.
But you would still need to send classical information to know what's happening or to complete this process. So,
well,
and this would still travel at some finite speed in the medium?
That's well. I think you need to sign this. You need to sign this classical information, if you want to. Yeah. So actually, there is an analog in this this wormhole case. So the statement is that the spatial distance between something near here, this is a near here. That's actually a black hole. So if you sit near the black hole horizon here, and I sit there, we are actually spatially very close by. But that doesn't mean you can send information from one to the other. We can both send information to the black hole inside. These two share the same inside of the black hole, but they have a short spatial spatial distance, but they don't have causal relations. Right? There's no time lag geodesic connecting them. Okay, so as long as I stick with the gapped states, this is a well-defined way to measure distance. So give me any state, well, I say I have a curved manifold and I create some massive state on top of it and then calculate, and then I don't tell you the metric of that manifold, but I give you this many-body wave function. I can just calculate the correlation function and then use that formula. So I will restore this geodesic distance. It won't be accurate in short range, but it's accurate in long range. Okay, so but then when you go to critical states, it's very different. So say, imagine I live in that system. I live in that universe, which only has massive particles. So I use this correlation function to measure distance. And then one day, this universe becomes critical. So the mass, there is a quantum phase transition, which means I now live in a critical universe. But that's not what I will observe inside. I mean, if you live outside, you will say, oh, nothing changed in the geometry, but the Hamiltonian has changed. I have a quantum phase transition. But if I live in that system, the only thing I access is the correlation functions. What do I see? I see that the correlation functions between two faraway points become bigger because the system is critical, right? Or more precisely, they decay slower, right? So like dxz now looks like a logarithmic function of the Euclidean distance because the correlation is a power law. So if you take a log, you get logarithmic functions of Euclidean distance. So what happened is, okay, if you are a physicist living in that universe, and then the universe get a phase transition to critical, you will look at this distance, and then you thought, okay, some geometry has changed. So my geometry becomes something like this, and it gives me this distance. But if you try to model your universe, then you'll find that there is some problem, because no metric will give me this distance. Why? Because even if you have a curved space, and with some metric, then the distance is always given by length of a geodesic line, right? As long as the distance is given by a length of a geodesic line, you can find the third point z on that geodesic line such that dxz plus dzy equals dxy. But for this log, you can check it's not possible. Right? Dxz plus dzy is always bigger than dxy. So that tells you that this distance is something that's not given by geodesic distance. So if you live in a universe, maybe you don't know what happened, but you know this thing doesn't apply anymore. You know this basis has something wrong. Like I cannot consider it as a massive state in a new geometry. But there is a very now from the hyperbolic from the holographic duality, we have a very simple interpretation of this fact that you don't have geodesic. You simply, so say, maybe one day you come up with a model and say, oh, I know what happened. The geometry is still Riemann geometry. There is still geodesic distance, but there is an additional dimension. I go through, there is a short path from the additional dimension. Then that's why this triangle never becomes a line, because the third point doesn't live in the actual dimension. So this motivation is a bit long, but it tells you that if you really want to define distance for a given choice of points, which means you decompose your Hilbert space into local, what do you call local sites, and then you calculate correlation. There is some basis which gives you a nice geometry, some basis which doesn't give you a nice geometry. And then what do you do there? Then the natural thing is you say maybe there is a basis where physics is more local. So this is not the really not the best choice for real space points anymore. Well, maybe I choose a basis in the Hilbert space. I choose another basis where the correlation functions become local again. So that's exactly this idea I'm going to propose, that that the duality is actually doing some unitary transformation in Hilbert space, which define a new set of points. And then in that new set of points, you can define the geometry, which is more well-defined. OK, so now I will explain what I really mean by this new basis, which you obtain by unitary transformation. And this unitary transformation is what I call the exact holographic mapping. So now let's start from this this boundary theory. So this blue point are let's say one dimensional lattice model. So there is a spin defined on each side. So you have a 1D chain with the Hilbert space direct product of each side. Now I can construct a unitary mapping by combining a lot of local unitary mapping. And this is a direct generalization of the idea of MIRA, this very nice proposal of Giffrey. This is simpler than what you usually use in MIRA because I didn't introduce disentanglers. I will explain more about the relation to MIRA two slides later. But let's define what do I mean by this network. So every vertex here, every vertex in the network is a unitary mapping. It's a two-site unitary mapping operator, which take these two sites, map it to these two sites, map it to the two sites on the outgoing line. And then physically, what I want to do is I want the red dot to represent the high energy degrees of freedom in the two sites. And I want the low energy dot, so I want the other dots to represent the low energy degrees of freedom. And then in the next step, I will take the low energy degree freedom of these two sides and these two sides and repeat this process. And then I pick again the high energy part and low energy part of it. So you see, this is really like just a real space renormalization. But the improvement is that I didn't throw away the high energy modes or trace over them or integrate them. I just keep the high energy modes there. So you just separate. You just relabel your degrees of freedom into high energy and low energy, and then so that's essential here because I want to say these red dots are my bulk degrees of freedom. So you see this whole thing. I mean, it's a multiplication of a bunch of unitaries. So of course, in the end, it's still a unitary mapping from your Hilbert space to the bulk Hilbert space, which is the same space with a different basis. So what you get is something which looks like a lattice model living in one dimension higher, because I didn't throw away the high energy states, so the high energy states and the low energy states are actually entangled with each other for a general initial state. So initially you may have entanglement between different sites, and in this new basis you talk about entanglement between different energy scales, and then say now after the whole mapping these just represent degrees of freedoms of the system at different energy scale, and they are entangled. And this entanglement, I will use this entanglement to map out the geometry.
This seems different from the standard point of view, where the physical degree freedom only live on the boundary. I mean, I don't know how much difference, because if you count total number Hilbert space, dimension Hilbert space, you just count the surface.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Here you need to do surface and the bulk.
No. These two are equivalent. So when you count the dimension, I mean, here the bulk theory and boundary theory has the same dimension of Hilbert space. They are just the same theory with a different basis. So.
But if you only count the degree on the boundary, there's a factor two smaller than.
No, because
the total one.
It's like just think of this as a very special time evolution, right? So this is like the initial state, and the red one is like the final state. So when you count Hilbert space, you don't count both of them. You count either one. Right?
But it's only space. This one-dimensional space.
Well, in the end, this direction will become spatial direction.
Yeah.
But when I define the mapping, let's look at the next slide. This mapping, I mean, this is just a more cartoon picture of the tensor network. So what happened is you define a unitary mapping. It's not the time evolution, but it's the same as time evolution. It's a unitary mapping. You define a unitary mapping between these states and the red states.
Yeah. But the difference in this picture, my question became more clear. So usually the total dimension of space is counting the blue dots.
That's true, still true here.
And that's true. But,
yeah.
But however, I think the Euro ADSFP is a really red dot picture.
but where the physical Hilbert space is only on the surface of red dot.
I think the difference is it's always talking about duality between two theories, right? So there are physical degree of freedoms in these two theories. And if you believe they are really completely equivalent, then the physical degree of freedom in the two theories are the same. So one theory has degree of freedoms living on the boundary, the other living in the bulk. So the only difference is like here, I may have some different, I mean, there may be some different fields living in the bulk. Like in the ordinary case, the field that lives in the bulk are like source terms on the boundary. Here it's not like that, but the general picture is the same, that you have two theories, the theory of the red and the theory of the blue, and they are equivalent. And here I just make this equivalence very trivial or very explicit, that they are just related by unitary mapping in the Hilbert space.
Okay. So in high dimension, for example, in 2+1D, so if you control such kind of map, the bulk and the bounded degree of freedom still they match or looks like.
I want every mapping to be unitary, so they still match. But you have, say, you take four sites and then you coarse grain into one site, and then that means that you take a quarter of the degree of freedom to low energy, and then the three quarters are in high energy. So there is some, like, each dot here may contain a different dimension. But in the end, when you sum them, you must match.
What are the dimensions? The physical degree of freedom in the box, in the unitary, is not the same degree. Same number.
Well, the number of sites decrease, at least in this choice, I make the dimension on each site.
For example, let's say on the boundary, just the icing spin, just the two dimension. But then in the 1D case, in the bulk, still two dimension.
Right.
But in the 2D case, like you have starting from 16, then you group four together, and then become four, and looks
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I mean the difference is that in 1D you have 2 to the n, and then I split it into 2 to the n-1 low energy and high energy, and then I split the low energy one into 2 to the n-2 and so on. So I keep doing it. So in the end, I get the sum of all these things give me the same dimension as that. In higher dimension, the only difference is there is a say 2 to the n x times n y. So then when you split it, it's not a 1-to-1 ratio, but like 3-to-1. Like you have the high energy states, which is like 3 times maybe 4, and then there is a 1 times 4, and then you can still go in. Yeah.
So you
yeah.
get rid of more states.
Right.
Excuse me. So like, would you mind explaining like why you keep the high energy mode as your like dark theory while like when you do
Because the low energy modes are gapless, and you need to further RG. It's the same as ordinary RG, that you separate the degree of freedom into high energy and low energy, and the low energy one is more important, which means you need something more non-trivial to treat it, right? So you do further mapping, and in the end, because also the goal is to get a theory in the bulk which looks massive. But of course, the energy spectrum of the two theory looks the same, so it's not really massive in the sense of energy gap. But it's a massive, it's a short-range entangled. So the goal is to get a short-range entangled state in the bulk. And that's why that's achieved by separating the degree of freedom and keep the high energy one here, because it has a finite energy scale. So the correlation is a finite correlation there.
No,
I cannot see it from here because I can feed in any state here. Right, so of course I can get any state out in the bulk. So in general, I cannot prove that you always get short-range entangled. So you need to make a choice of the mapping. So for each given boundary state, there is some choice of the mapping which make the bulk short-range correlated. It's like if you do the wrong RG, then you may keep the low-energy states here, and then the correlation becomes very high, very long-range. So it's not like you make one choice and work for every state. Okay, and the relation to the mirror is that actually mirror use a more sophisticated version of this mapping, but it has the same geometry that is hyperbolic, and it's more complicated than a tree, then the mirror idea is that you have a direct product state in the bulk, and then you feed that back. Then you get a state on the boundary. Right? So in this way, In this way, then you define a state. So what I define here is a mapping. And then when you act this mapping on a special state in the bulk, then you get a special state on the boundary. And this state on the boundary has this has enough entanglement to characterize critical system. So that's the relation. Like like in this holographic mapping, I would like to allow entanglement between different bulk states. And that's important to map out the geometry. And then so in that sense it's generalizing Meron. So then the hope is that this can sort of describe the geometry in a more constructive way, because if you have no entanglement between different bulk sites, then when you modify the state, the only way you can say you go from gapped to gapless states, you have to modify the whole network. You may make the network different shape, something like that. And here, because I have this bulk correlation between different bulk sites, which I can use to probe the geometry, so I don't need to change the network by hand. Even if I use the same mapping network, I can get different geometries if I feed in different boundary states. And I should mention that Mira has been proposed to relate to ADS CFT. So you can view this work as a generalization of these approaches. Okay, so now once I define this mapping, then I can just define correlation function and define distance. So I can not only map out the space geometry, but I can also map space time geometry if you allow me to use imaginary time. So you can calculate correlation function between point operators in different time, and then use the same kind of formula to map out the time direction distance. And I will use that. That will be essential to understand why black hole emerges automatically from a finite temperature on the boundary. So for time direction, the problem is I don't have something like a local, like mutual information. Like equal time correlator is bounded by mutual information. Different time correlator, I don't know what bounds it. So I would have to define it for some choice of operators. It will be interesting to find such a bound of correlation function. But a different choice of operators probably only give you a different factor in front. Okay, so now let's take this very simple system. In general, for interacting system, it's very hard to calculate correlation function. So what I can really explicitly calculate is for a free fermion. So let's take this free fermion. So the Hamiltonian looks like that, which is just a regularized Dirac model. So you have a k-linear term, and then some mass term, and then you add some cutoffs, some regularization. And in real space, it's actually just like it's just a 1D chain with nearest neighbor coupling. And then here, this mapping is very simple. So the mapping I choose, which separates different length scale or different energy scale, is simply you take bounding antibounding states of the two sides. And the antibounding state, when you Fourier transform it, it has a momentum mainly near pi and near pi. So that's what you call the high energy state. And then the other one is mainly near momentum zero, and that's called low energy state. And the choice is not unique. You can make different choices, but this choice. So I make this choice because it maps the Hamiltonian in a nice way, that it shows you that the Hamiltonian, when you map this chain into A and B, then the Hamiltonian of the low energy chain actually looks the same as before, except that the mass is renormalized. So that's exactly what you expect when you do this RG, that the mass grows and the critical, if you have a massless system, the Hamiltonian remains the same except overall renormalization factor. So that's why I choose this Hamiltonian. And because all the later steps is renormalizing A, so if you make this A Hamiltonian the same every step, then you basically guarantee that when you have a massless system, the bulk correlation functions are already scale invariant. So now actually, when you combine this unitary mapping together and get this unitary mapping in the whole Hilbert space, because every step you are doing some single particle transformation, so in the end you get something very simple. You get a basis transformation like a Fourier transform from this local basis to another basis. And that the other basis turns out to be actually some wavelet, right? Which is natural because it's local and it also has some sense, some information about landscape. So if you do that mapping and iterate it, it turns out what you get is a wavelet basis, so called hard wavelet. So what does that mean? It means a delta function in the bulk living at a point corresponds to a boundary wave function that lives on this side. And the wave function has this shape, plus and minus half of the size. So if you have a different site in the bulk, it corresponds to a different corresponds to a different wavelet, which has a different location and also a different size. So you can check that all these are orthogonal to each other. For free fermion case, the physics simply reduced to like the bulk physics is simply the same model as the boundary, but you talk about the physics in the wavelet basis. So the wavelet basis lives in 2D because it has a dimension that represents the energy scale, which means the size of the wavelet. And then we will show that numerically that that indeed the physics is more local in that basis than the boundary. So you calculate correlation functions, and the nice thing is that we can just input whatever state we like. As long as it's free fermion, we know how to calculate it. So let's first check this simplest case where I have a critical system, so zero mass and zero temperature. So you just calculate the correlation functions on the boundary and then do this basis transformation, map it to the bulk. And then what happened is, now when I calculate this mutual information between different sites and take a log, I get a distance according to my definition. So I get this distance, and then I can compare it with the distance, the geodesic distance in the ADS space. So the way you compare is you give every site a coordinate, and the coordinate is determined because of the scale invariance. So you if you determine the coordinate of one site, all others are determined by scale invariance because the parameter of the first layer is twice the parameter of the second layer. So you assign this coordinate. In more general cases, you may not know like what geometry I compare with. I mean, the geometry is still defined by that formula. But in more generally, maybe you don't know which continuous geometry to compare with. But in this special case, you know that the natural thing you compare with is the ADS space. And then say in the two points that are in the same radius, in ADS 3, it has a distance asymptotically looking like a log function. So you just compare this correlation function, this distance obtained from correlation function with that distance. So indeed, you see that, so this is the geometrical, this is the geodesic distance, and this is the distance I get from correlation function. And these two figures are distance in the angle direction and the distance in the radial direction. So basically, what this means is that your correlation function, although the correlation function still looks like power law in the function of this angle direction, but now in this new lattice model on 2D, it's actually understood as local, as exponential decay, because the geodesic distance between these two points is a log function of the boundary distance. So this is showing that if I define the distance in this way, then I do get a hyperbolic space in the bulk, and I can even map out what is the ADS radius. And the ADS radius is of order one; it's smaller than one. So we have a new paper with my student Xinhua Li and I, where Xinhua worked out all these analytic results. So you can calculate using the asymptotic formula, asymptotic behavior of correlation function, you can get ADS radius, and it's a consistent that the ADS radius is of order of the lattice constant, because we know in ADS CFT that the number of degree freedom in ADS radius is like some power of n, and here n equal to one, so it's on each lattice site I only have one degree of freedom, so it's natural that this area of ADS radius only include something like one site. So you can also study the time direction. As I mentioned, I don't have mutual information. So I have to use this this 2-point function. So there is there may be some power. There's some, when you compare it with spatial direction, there is some factor 2 here, because yeah, I use a 2-point function, and the mutual information basically decays like a 4-point function. But when I calculate this time direction distance and compare it with the formula in ADS, in the global ADS, and this also work very well. So indeed, it gives you agreement with the ADS geometry. But that's not very surprising, because by construction, I choose this RG scheme so that the bulk is scale invariant, right? So most of the behavior is determined by scale invariants. But the interesting thing is that this network I draw doesn't specify the bulk geometry. The network defines the mapping, and then you need to feed in a boundary state to get a geometry. So now I can just keep the same network and feed in a different state, and say people are interested in black hole, which is due to a boundary finite temperature. So I can just feed in a boundary finite temperature thermal density matrix, and that will give me a different correlation function, right? And I just view the correlation functions in the new basis in the bulk, and ask, okay, what does the geometry look like? So let's look at the spatial correlation, so equal time correlation.
Sorry,
yeah.
Just to check, so you determine the circuit, the gates that you're using here, using the original Hendel time.
Right.
So you use that.
In this case,
you just build some C1 plus C2.
I use the same mapping, yeah.
But that mapping was inspired by the original Hendel time.
Right, right.
But so now you take the Hendel time, the original Hendel time, and you
right.
can see the thermal state
for that yes.
Okay.
Right. Right. Or in other words, you can say it's like I can map the Hamiltonian to the bulk Hamiltonian, and then I'm just turn on a temperature in the bulk. So, yeah. So I turn on a temperature and then calculate correlation functions. And in the spatial direction, of course, it's not surprising that you get a correlation function now become exponential decay in this boundary distance, right? So exponential decay means when you take this distance, which is the log of correlation function, you get that the long distance behavior of the distance now becomes Euclidean. So when you take 2 points that are separated in this angle direction, and then you plot the distance, you see crossover from this log behavior of low temperature to a linear behavior in the log behavior of short range, which comes from zero temperature, and the linear behavior in long distance. But the crossover happens at different points when you go deeper and deeper into the bulk. So when you go deeper and deeper into the bulk, you see the crossover happens earlier and earlier. And that's simply because the temperature is the same everywhere, but the energy scale of the bulk hopping Hamiltonian decays exponentially when you go to the center. Right? So that means effectively the bulk size in the IR has a higher temperature. And it's simply because of that, you calculate the correlation function, you see that the bulk, like the distance between two nearby points, like these 2 points, the distance between these 2 points is the same if you have zero temperature. Like these 2 points has the same distance as these two because of scale invariance if you have zero temperature. But at finite temperature, the nearby points get farther and farther away, which just means they get less and less correlated. As a consequence, you have this nice consequence that I can measure the parameter of a circle, which means I measure the distance of these two multiplied by number of sides. And then you see that the number of sides decay exponentially when you go inside, and the distance between two nearby sides grows exponentially. So in the end, what you get is that the parameter, or I should call it area in the more general higher dimensions, is some like an area of this circle approach a constant when you go to IR limit. And that's exactly telling you that there is a hole in the center. Right, the geometry, when you draw the network, it looks like a disk. But actually, if you live in a universe and use that formula to calculate distance, you see there is a hole. The center part is broken, because when you walk around it, there is a finite distance. Right. So we know this hole should be the black hole. But so far, we haven't shown it's black.
So here we haven't shown it's black. The gray area doesn't mean anything, right?
No, it means the stretch of the horizon. It means the area that's near to black hole horizon.
But the point even inside of shaded area is still
outside
accessible,
right.
Still outside
the horizon. Right. So that part, that region is called a stretched horizon, which means it's the region where temperature is very high. I'm very close to horizon, but I'm still outside. Yeah. I never use anything inside.
So
because
there's no inside power. Yeah.
No, there's no inside because you the inside doesn't go out, so you don't need them to map the boundary. Right? And then how do I know this hole is a black hole? And then actually you can look at the time direction. I mean, because if you only look at the space, then it tells you the space terminates at somewhere in the center, but it doesn't tell you what happened to time. So now you can just calculate time direction correlation and map out the metric in the same way. So what do I pull out here is the distance between two points, distance between two points like here and here, which has the same spatial coordinate and different time. And this is imaginary time. So at finite temperature, of course, everything is periodic in beta, in imaginary time. So you have distance increases, and then there's periodic boundary condition. But if you look at this part, when you go from UV to IR, which means go from the boundary to the inside, the slope is smaller and smaller. And actually, it decays exponentially when you go to IR limit. So what does that mean? When you go back to the correlation function, short distance means a strong correlation, right? So it tells you that when you are near here, you see this distance grows, which means your correlation function decays exponentially in time direction. But when you are in here, where you are in IR, then the correlation almost doesn't decay when you go to the time direction. So it's not like a very short range, it's the reverse. It's like almost very long range. Like the two-point function almost doesn't decay in time, in the imaginary time. But why is that? It's simply because you are in the high temperature limit there. Like you have a region in the center where the temperature is the highest scale, and your Hopping and all these terms in your Hamiltonian is very small there. So if you think about the reduced density metrics of the IR region, it's basically infinite temperature reduced density metrics. So there is no natural time evolution. That's basically the interpretation that when you calculate this two-point correlation function in time direction, you see that the spatial correlation decays very very fast in this center region, but the time direction decays very slow, and that's exactly what you expect for when you're close to a black hole. Right? When you're closer and closer to a black hole, you expect the time direction become more and more lifelike. In the end, it becomes lifelike, and that's the horizon. So that confirms that this geometry looks like a black hole, and actually I can fit this black hole formula. Yeah.
So the boundary theory is just a free fermion theory
right.
At finite temperature.
Yes. And so it's not claiming that this theory is due to a semi-classical geometry or a classical geometry. It's some kind of average. It's a geometry defined in an average sense that. If I look at the fluctuations away from this geometry, it's very different from Einstein theory because in the bulk, I still have a free fermion theory. Right? So the bulk theory is like, I have this geometry on average when I calculate the correlation function. But if I look at fluctuations, dynamics, then they are free fermion. So that's not contradictory with what we know that the free fermion doesn't map to a nice bulk geometry. Okay, and then when you fit this correlation in the bulk in the time direction, you can also get this parameter as a function of layer index. Like when you go to the center, you'll see the parameter approach a constant number, and that's the black hole radius. And then you can check that the black hole radius is proportional to temperature. And also there's something related to black hole entropy also. So when I look at this site, so now here this is a cartoon which shows how the geometry looks like. So you have like less and less sites, but they actually don't get close to each other. So in the end, the geometry is like all these IR sites are in this pink region. That's the stretch of the horizon. But although they seem to occupy a small area there, but they actually carry a lot of entropy. Because when you calculate the entropy of every site in the infrared, every site in the infrared, that's maximum. And so we will show later that actually the interpretation is every site there entangled very little with each other, but they entangle strongly, maximally with the thermal bath. So that's basically that IR part near the black hole. contains most of your thermal entropy, and that's the that's consistent with the black hole entropy.
But let me see, how thick the layer you need to compute the black hole entropy, or do you need to have a thick?
I think you can take a cutoff in this, say in this exponential decay, you take some cutoff there, count all the sides on the other side.
Yeah, but how that may affect the black hole entropy?
Well,
I mean, usually we say per area there's something, but if you choose different thickness, whether the black hole entropy per area may have some log dependence or something.
I think it gives you some corrections that are subleading, because what happened is, if you look at this curve, when you have a more size, so I increase the size of the system from 2 to the n to, I increase the n in the 2 to the n. So I have a bigger size. Then the you actually have more size on that side rather than on this side. So basically, if you take any cutoff here, when you do a finite size scaling, increase the system size, it's this part which is increasing. So the volume law part comes from the stretched horizon. The corrections may be a constant which comes from, depending on where you do the cutoff.
I see.
And I mean, this
thermal entropy, mostly just almost all of them come from the house. Some thin layer around this house.
Most of them. I think it's also in the, like in the semi-classical geometry case, if you consider it completely classical, then it's all there. But if you consider corrections, then there is some small portion outside. And this case is like there is maybe some finite portion outside, but still subleading. Yeah. Okay, so you can check this also. You can study other geometries. Like, I would like to compare the finite temperature black hole case with a finite mass. So when you have a finite mass, then the spatial correlation looks similar to finite to the finite temperature but zero mass. Right? It decays exponentially. So due to the same argument that I have, when you walk around this circle, you will see that there is a hole in the center at the parameter saturates to a constant, which is proportional to mass in this case. But the time duration looks very different, because now there is a mass which is controls the time duration decay everywhere. So indeed, you get a geometry which has a hole in the center, but that's not a black hole. So the time duration remains constant. So it's just spatial geometry, spatial annulus times some time. You can also see the difference in terms of the entropy. So this is the entropy of each site. And in the black hole case, there is this neighborhood of this border which carries a lot of entropy. And in the finite mass case, you see it drops. So the infrared part contributes very little to the entropy.
Sorry, I'm confused. So you started with the Hamiltonian, that is Gapless?
No, I turn on the mass, yeah.
But your Hamiltonian is still Gapless, and you're starting the time evolution of...
Oh, no, this is a massive time evolution. Yeah.
So
I changed the
Hamiltonian.
Right.
You build another geometry after
right.
a bit, so
right.
the quantum circuit is different now?
Right. No, the quantum circuit is the same. The mapping is the same. I can fit in different states. I can also fit in different Hamiltonians.
Right, but you created the mapping.
Right, the mapping is...
For a given Hamiltonian, which was Gapless.
Right.
Now
I didn't change the mapping.
So you keep that mapping,
that's
now
right.
you change the Hamiltonian.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So it's certainly not, I mean, if I have some kind of optimization procedure, then this is probably not the optimized geometry, optimized mapping for this one. It's sort of like I'm looking at different geometry starting from a given background.
But this time evolution is on the ground state of the new Hamiltonian.
Right.
And you're just looking at two-point correlators.
Yes.
So the state itself is not evolving in time. The state is an eigenstate of the new Hamiltonian.
Right. The correlation function. There is correlation function in time. The state is not evolving in time. Then you see that the IR part now, indeed, there is this border in IR, which is not a horizon, which doesn't carry entropy. Right. So this is also something when I did this, I like this fact that you can distinguish finite temperature and finite mass, because if you just draw a mirror network and try to use that as a dual as a geometry, then you don't have explicitly have the time direction. So it's hard to distinguish these cases, because in this previous proposals, the network represents a state. right? So then, so here the advantage is that that you have a you can just fill in different states to get different geometry. And another thing, so I'm just showing different different examples. Another thing that's related to the finite temperature case is I want to study this doubled theory, the thermal double, which means it's a pure state, but when you trace over one of the states, you get a thermal density matrix of the other. So in the boundary theory, it's simply some entangled two chains. When you trace over one chain, you get the other is thermal. Now I still use the same mapping, and then the mapping will give me these two disks in the bulk. And if I calculate coordinate functions in each in the same layer, it will be the same as calculating coordinate function in the thermal density matrix. It will be the same as what we showed earlier. So if I leave on one layer, I will see that it's a black hole. But if I measure a distance between points in the two different layers, then that tells me some interesting thing, that because of the entanglement, the two layers are actually connected. Because their distance is finite, right? Because they have a finite correlation, right? They have an entanglement. So the correlation between these two dots is finite. If it's zero temperature, then they will have no correlation. And so this gives you this way that you can map out the two-sided black hole or the wormhole geometry. Like this is the distance of two sides that's right on top of each other. And then when you move in to the center, you see the distance between these two points decays, and they decay exponentially when you go to the IR limit. So that's just confirming what I said earlier, that the IR size, the reason why they are entangled very little with each other and they have a maximum entropy is just they simply entangle with the thermal bath. So they entangle vertically. So although the mapping topologically looks like two disks, two separate disks, if I define the distance in this way, you will see that the geometry is actually a wormhole that's connected through IR. That the distance goes to zero, so there is a region in the IR which is actually just attached to each other. And then you can study some more complicated things, like how about if I do a quantum quench to this state? And this is motivated by this last work of Hartmann and Montesina last year, that they studied this quantum quench. So you have this thermal state, which is invariant under some time evolution of h right plus h left, which is this, which corresponds to this time slice in the Pongrace diagram. So this is the symmetry of the state. So nothing happens when you do this. But if you do a different time evolution, which looks the same in each side, but they reverse the direction, then that's a non-trivial time evolution. That's a quench. So you do a HR minus HL, which in the Pongrace diagram looks like you are going up in both directions. Then the geometry looks different. Then the spatial geometry, like the distance between these two points, is not the same as the distance at time zero, right? You go up. So and they studied that in that geometry, and here we can study this using this quantum state. So I just do this quantum quench using that Hamiltonian, and then measure how this distance between two points change in time. So what happened is you see that, say, this is the distance of two points right on top of each other, and both of them are near the border. And then you see that the distance grows in time, which is consistent qualitatively with this picture, that the two parts got farther and farther away, like this wormhole got stretched. But quantitatively, it's different. Here, the distance grows logarithmically in time. And in their classical geometry, the distance grows linearly. And there is actually a natural explanation why there is such a difference. Because what happened here for free fermion is that when I do a time evolution, this, say you start from some electron staying here, it will just diffuse into some finite region. And then in ADS space, this region has a area that's linear in time. The area scales the same way as parameter in ADS. So it scales, it's like a something. So that the entanglement between two sides will be threaded in a region of order t. So that means if you calculate the average, like entanglement between two points in that new system, it will be like it's the number of states entangled between the two will be reduced by a factor of 1 over t. And when you take a log, you get the log t dependence. And if you have an interacting system, like this classical geometry should be due to a very strongly interacting system, then you don't just diffuse into this finite area, but your information which contains in a single particle will diffuse in the whole Hilbert space. It can go to multi-particle states. And the number of states in that given regime is the exponential function of t. Right? The t is the volume of that regime. So the number of states is the exponential of that. So when you take a log, you get linear dependence. So that's my interpretation why the wormhole is stretched slower here than the classical geometry. And you can calculate. So this blue part is like the wormhole where the distance between two sides on top of each other is very short. And the red part is when they are very far away. So in time, you see, so this actually, I use a scale here so this is actually log t. And then you get a periodic reentrance because of the fact, because the system is free, so there's no real thermalization. And in an interacting system, you don't expect this part. You expect it to come back in a Poincaré recurrence time. I should wrap up. So these are the main results here. And since I run out of time, I will just quickly skip over this these ongoing works. So basically, you can study different geometries by inputting different states on the boundary. Say I can, instead of inputting the thermal state, I can add some random phase difference between the two sides. And then you can see that in general, these two wormholes the two sides of the wormholes get far away if you do a random perturbation. It's like this Shanker-Stanford case where you shoot in a shockwave and then create a firewall, something like that. You add a random perturbation, then the two sides in general got very far away. And then you can also try to study, say, black hole macrostate, where which means I try to create something looks like a black hole, but it's actually a pure state. There's no the other side. And then you can do that by, say, create a random state, and the random state is like, if it's completely random, then it's like infinite temperature. Correlation function looks like infinite temperature. And then you can cool it down, and then you get, it's still a pure state. You cool down a random state, then you can get something that the correlation function looks like a finite temperature, but actually it's a pure state if you look at all correlation functions. So that's an interesting case because that's when you want to understand like where the information goes, everything is unitary and so on. So you can calculate a correlation function in this case, and you see that the UV region looks like a regular, there is a good space-time, there is a geometry is well-defined, and then in the IR region, there is just no locality, and there is random correlation between different sites, which comes from this infinite temperature feature. So, okay, so, and we are trying to go to interacting system, and this use the feature of the cultural cone, which was studied in MIRA. And fortunately, we still have this cultural cone structure here, which means the correlation functions on the boundary can be determined by only looking at physics in that region in the bulk, which is not so big, which is, say, 2 times log L, the system size. And then hopefully using this method, you can reverse this mapping and then and calculate correlation functions of some interacting system by input a simpler bulk state. And then map it to a more complicated boundary state so that you can study the correlation function by knowing the bulk. So I will stop there. And of course, there is a lot of open questions, say continuum model, or how do I relate to the standard ADS-CFT, and how do I do Larian limit, and so on. Thanks.
Go ahead.
This kind of like structure can like you actually reproduce like if we have the distance in the dark, then we can like it's sort of equivalent to the correlation functions in the boundary. So and then like so what about say like quantum entanglement? Can you see such kind of like so in quantum entanglement, like we have those kind of like minimal surface in the bulk, which like, so can this kind of mapping be reflected in your like structure?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I guess it's related to this like real Takanagi formula, which related the entropy to minimal surface. So basically, what happened here is if I only look at the mapping, it doesn't tell me anything about It doesn't tell me anything about the entanglement, say between this region and the rest of the boundary, because the mapping itself is can be applied to any state, right? So it's a property. The entropy is a property of state. But if I use a bulk state on top of this, so it's like here. If I have some bulk state and then map it back to a boundary state, then for a given bulk state, I can ask about the entanglement in the boundary. And then you can prove that if the bulk has an area law entropy, which is what we want. We want some short-range correlative state in the bulk. So the bulk has an area law entropy, and that will give you this boundary entanglement between two regions in the boundary will be bounded by this minimal surface. So the difference from the Mira network case is in Mira, all the entanglement is given by the network explicitly. So the entropy per area is like determined by the bound dimension in the mirror network. Here it comes from two origins. There is a part of it given by the network and the other part come from the bulk state itself.
Wondering about locality though. Do you expect to recover that enlargement from coupling limit or is it already there?
Well, there are different sense of locality. So if you talk about the large scale locality, it's local here. I have compared it with the ADS, which means the correlation function indeed decay exponentially with the distance. So in that sense, it's local. But there is no locality in scale smaller than ADS readers are. And that's what you expect the large N to play an essential role, which I still don't know how to do here.
So here, you only consider a free tensor network in the box. What if we change it to a Hong Kong tensor network or other latitudes in the box?
Is
that still exponential decay?
In general, it depends on what state you apply to, right? So I expect, say, if you already have a mirror description of some system, and then I use that network, then the bulk is certainly short-range correlated because it can be approximated by product state. In general, it will depend on the system. But sometimes, in some system, I will have to use that. Because say, for example, I have this description to this quantum quench case, but I didn't modify the mapping. So my mapping actually corresponds to the red slices, which are completely leaving outside the black hole. So I can measure that they got far away from each other, but I have nothing inside the black hole. So I'm interested if you modify the network, say by introducing these disentanglers, then you may be able to get a different state in the bulk, which may correspond to these different slices.
In the usual ADS safety duality, we impose some like a global ADS symmetry on the boundary, then there's a local ADS symmetry in bulk. So in your case, how can I see there's a local conformal symmetry? Because the
No, I don't have a local. I don't even have this the conformal symmetry.
But whether there's a conservation law on the boundary would translate to some gate theory in the bulk or whether such thing.
Because I didn't do the duality, it's a mapping the fermions to fermions. So for example, fermion has a charge conservation, then the bulk still have fermion with the charge conservation. So I don't explicitly have say gauge field due to that. But if I say I focus on the singular sectors, and if you do something like that, then it's like I take the bulk free fermion theory, but I insist only looking at the bilinears of the fermions, then there's some gauge field emerging from it.
Okay, so if I live in a many body state and measure the distance with the correlation functions, so can I have an intrinsic definition of the dimension?
You may have some definition. I mean, you can have a Hausdorff definition of the dimension.
You can have a wrapper geometry.
But it will depend on, it still depends on the mapping I use.
Okay, so with no further questions, let's thank Shailin again.
Thank you.